Welcome to Conversations in World History. This is the second part of my pre-Columbian Mesoamerica series with professors John Schwaller and Matthew Restall. This is the part where we talk about the Toltecs and we dissect the ways in which the World History Patterns of Interaction textbook get things right, get things wrong, and leave things out. The conversation is wide-ranging and includes insights that can be helpful for us to think about how we approach history in general and all of these pre-Columbian civilizations, whether in Mexico or elsewhere. Hope you enjoy the conversation and check out episode 1 about Teotihuacan and episode 3 about the Mexica or the Aztecs.
All right. So after Teotihuacan, then, and I'm really, as John can tell, I'm really working on my pronunciation there. Then we move into the Toltecs, and there are three paragraphs about the Toltecs that discuss Quetzalcoatl. What did you guys think about this section on the Toltecs? What's kind of the major theme that comes out? John, maybe you start us off here. What's it trying to say about them, and what does it do well?
It was somewhat like fingernails on a blackboard. It was quite disturbing. I thought that this myth of Quetzalcoatl, which most people say Quetzalcoatl, had been relegated to the dustbin of history. But here I see it explaining the civil war in Tula. We know that, yes, there was a civil war. We know, yes, that there were individuals who were associated with the two different political factions in Tula. And yes, they might have had the name of Quetzalcoatl or of Tezcatlipoca. It's not unheard of for individuals to have names of deities. After all, we have children named Jesus and any number of other things. But to see it in a textbook was somewhat disturbing.
John, can you just to back up for people who aren't looking at this directly, what is it? What is it that they say?
What they say is that somewhere around the year 1000, that there was a revolt inside of Tula between two essentially religious factions, one who encouraged human sacrifice, the other who encouraged the end of human sacrifice and a more, I don't know what you would say, transcendental kind of religion. And this latter group was identified with Quetzalcoatl, a deity who, according to one particular legend, traveled off to the east and pledged to return again. This was a legend which was latched on to by the Spaniards and later used as a justification for their attacks on Mesoamerican peoples, that they were in fact the embodiment of Quetzalcoatl. Whether or not it's got any basis in reality is very questionable. And as Matthew and I both have studied, and I think both of us have written at one point or another, probably has no validity whatsoever, that it is it's an image that was, again, latched onto by the Spaniards and made as an explanation for how things happened.
Matthew, having read your books, I'm going to make the wild prediction here that you're going to agree with John on his on his problems.
Sorry. I know it's more fun if Fritz and I can argue, and we may argue about something before we're done here, but he's totally spot on. I mean, this is where the train just goes right off the tracks here.
Yeah, completely.
You when you go from Teotihuacan into the Toltecs, and then the unsuspecting reader, student reader, would have no idea that, you know, here we are going along perfectly reasonably, and all of a sudden there's an explosion and the train is, like, you know, lying on the ground, and there's, you know, smoke and flames and people are screaming. It's an absolute train wreck.
That sounds like that would make school more interesting for some students if things like that were going. But okay.
Well, and what it is it's what we alluded to earlier in our conversation. It is a tainted line of evidence that is creeping in here. And it is presented as if, that somehow we know what was happening in central Mexico in the 11th century, in the same way we know about how many pyramids there were in Teotihuacan. Right, because if you're just reading this as a student, you're not being told where the lines of evidence are originating, so
or where the uncertainty is.
Yeah, so like here's facts: the city was Teotihuacan was abandoned by 750, and then here's another fact: we've got something very specific. We've got the name of the ruler, the year when it happened. I mean, it really looks convincing, right? It looks very specific. Well, the reason it's very specific is because the people who made this up were making it up in the 16th century. So they were making it up in terms of, we're looking at a period of going back over 1,000 years, right? Relatively recently, this was made up by people who were, by the way, from Spain.
Made up about something just in terms of time period happening 500 years before.
Yeah. That. So okay. there's two possibilities here. As one is that there was stories, legends, historical memory, that it, to some degree did involve somebody called Topiltzin and a deity or a set of deities or a ruler deity or whatever called Quetzalcoatl. And that there was a story that involves some kind of conflict, internal conflict, that is then told by Nahuatl speakers in the 16th century to Franciscan friars, who then see in it an echo of stories from the Bible. Right. There's like they see, okay, well, this is a parallel to what we're trying to do, which is where the good guys coming in. We are essentially kind of the on the right side of this conflict. And we are battling against the bad guys.
The parallel, Matthew, is the returning God.
Yeah, that's right. Okay. So if people are not seeing the text in front, the way this is set up is that there's a conflict between those who want to continue to engage in human sacrifice. We're going to come to that phrase in a minute, because that's a whole nest full of red flags, right? So those who want to continue human sacrifice and those who want to stop it. So the Franciscans, therefore, are seeing themselves in the camp of people who want to stop it. They're on the side of good versus evil, the right kinds of practices, and so on. So that's one interpretation. The other interpretation, which is where Fritz was going, which I think is I agree with Fritz, is that so much of this is invented and just taken out of out of the Bible, out of Christian dogma, and so on, that it could be that the only part of this that has any real basis in Toltec reality is simply the word Quetzalcoatl. That could be it, right? We can't be sure, but what we can be sure is that these three paragraphs here are not only wrong, but they're like terribly, terribly misleading. And they kind of set the reader up for grossly misunderstanding what happens with the Aztecs. And they also are rooted in a way of looking at Mesoamerica that goes back almost 100 years and is completely wrong. And that is this idea that there's bloodthirsty native peoples here and non-bloodthirsty native peoples, right? That goes back to the era of the Second World War, when there was this prevailing notion among people in countries that in the war were the Allies, that there were peace-loving peoples and there were evil warlike peoples, right? And that was the simple way of looking at Second World War, right? Bad Germans, bad Japanese, good Americans, good English, good French, and so on. And the people who were writing this stuff obviously were overwhelmingly in the English-speaking world. And they had a kind of simplified way of looking at the world, which we would not agree with now at all, right? We would not, try to categorize the entire German peoples as being warlike and everybody in England being peaceful. That's totally absurd. But that idea is applied to Mesoamerica. And there are theories like, the Aztecs were warlike just like the Nazis. But the Mayas, who incidentally here are wrongly characterized as being Mayan with an N. It's not the Mayas. They were more like the Allies. They were peace loving. They were stargazing, you know, priest kings and so on. So you've got this just completely wrong ways of looking at different Mesoamerican groups. This is still echoed in here where it says that Teotihuacan, there's no evidence that they tried to create an empire and attack their neighbors. I don't know where they got that idea from. Well, I do, but it's wrong. And then the Toltecs, on the other hand, were really, they were, quote, an extremely warlike people whose empire was based on conquest. I mean, it doesn't make any sense. Like, if you're going to have a world history textbook, is there such a thing as extremely warlike people? That's kind of a racist concept. Aren't human beings extremely warlike people?
Yeah, I was...
Who create empires based on conquest? Yes, all people are. Or they're not, but don't try and divide human beings in racial terms, you know, into these two categories. So I think there's some sentences in here that, oh my God, you could spend an entire class just unpacking that one sentence and trying to figure out.
I want to ask John about that one, because that sentence really stuck out to me. Let me read that whole sentence, John. And I know Matthew got a little bit worked up there as he was reading that sentence. So you could jump in. The Toltecs were an extremely warlike people whose empire was based on conquest. They worshipped a fierce war god who demanded blood and human sacrifice from his followers. Okay. And that, as Matthew said, is stated as fact, right? Yeah. What are your thoughts, John, as you read that?
You really have to also read it in context of what was just written about Teotihuacan, that there is no evidence that Teotihuacan conquered its neighbors or tried to create an empire. Unfortunately, archaeology tells us different, that in fact, we say Teotihuacan style all the way down into Guatemala. And we are fairly sure that there were, I don't know how to characterize it, but perhaps armed camps of individuals from what is now Central Mexico, representing Teotihuacan down in Central America. Whereas with Tula, some of the evidence is quite equivocal. We do have the creation of a late empire in Maya regions, which Matthew can refer to, where we see a melding of the Maya and the Toltecs. So on the basis of archaeology, the two don't stand. The other is, Matthew has pointed it out completely appropriately, extremely warlike people is just completely unheard of in a standard presentation of history, and that they worshipped a fierce war god who demanded blood and human sacrifice. That also just sets my teeth on edge. It's just not at all appropriate, and also not realistic.
So even if you were... So yeah, that really jumped out at me. And again, this is a modern recent textbook, right? It's not written in the 1950s. It's not written in the early 1900s. And overall, a very high quality textbook used in great schools in New York. Leaving aside the extremely warlike people, which you guys said is really a derogatory way to refer to any group of people, still most people who know anything about the Aztecs or their pre-Columbian civilization see the demanded blood and human sacrifice. Well, isn't that just a fact about Aztec and pre-Columbian Mesoamerican civilization? Or are you guys arguing that itself is wrong?
That itself is wrong. Matthew and I have had a series of discussions when he was working on his book and I was working on mine on Panquetzaliztli, where we really have to think about these civilizations in a way that is less colored by what the Spaniards and the friars in particular were telling us, and try and understand them in terms of larger civilizations, as well as the logic that is imposed by the language and the peoples themselves. although I think in my last book I did use the term sacrifice, I'm moving away from it completely, and looking at it more in terms of public execution.
Mm. Yeah, I think to be generous to the writers of the textbook, this is an area in which the field has been moving fairly quickly, fairly recently. Yep. Yep. And there are a lot of well-established and fine scholars who still cling to this idea and are not willing to abandon the phrase human sacrifice, and do not accept the argument that that others of us are making, which is that it's essentially a racist loaded term, because you're not using human sacrifice to describe Protestants and Catholics burning each other alive at the stake for political religious reasons. And that is something that is going on at exactly the same time that the Aztecs are supposedly obsessed with human sacrifice, and in numbers that are perfectly comparable.
Or English disemboweling Scots and cutting off their heads and putting them on pikes at pretty much the same time.
Which often, you know, undergraduates or high school students are kind of aware of that, but they don't make those connections, right? Maybe they've seen Braveheart. I know it's kind of an old movie now, but maybe they've seen Braveheart and then they've seen Apocalypto. And it's all just kind of like, you know, violent adventure movies. And they maybe don't kind of make the connections like, okay, all societies engage in ritualized violence and ritualized execution. But when it comes to Europeans, we have ways of describing it as if it's sort of justified, right? It's judicious. It's sort of part of its kind of a process, and it doesn't somehow taint that culture. So the fact that in Elizabethan England, the English are sacrificing each other, burning each other at the stake over differences of religion within the same religion. They're not even burning people who aren't Christians, right? They're burning Christians because the wrong kind of Christianity. We don't allow that to infect our understanding of that as being the era of Shakespeare. This is like high culture, right? Absolutely kind of placed on a pedestal. But when it comes to the Aztecs, the fact that every now and then, I would argue less often than the English are murdering each other ritually and in public, every now and then somebody is ritually, elaborately executed in the capital city. But we use that to be like the absolute center point of that entire civilization, and we completely ignore the possibility that this might be a culture that is just as devoted to art and literature and ideas and so on as the English were in Elizabethan England. I think actually you want to compare those two civilizations, their complete record of art and literature and ideas and philosophy and so on. I think the Aztecs, look, these are my people, right? I'm descended from Londoners going back hundreds of years. And I would say the Aztecs probably will come out to be far more impressive than the English. Shakespeare's great, but it's not only about Shakespeare. You've got to look at the entire picture. So, you know, make that little rant, my little rant, right? And then go back to what we're being told here. The setup is about fallen redemption. So the setup with the Toltecs, if we come to the end here, I'll read it because I know everyone doesn't have it in front of them, right? So in time, Topilsin and Quetzalcoatl became one of the legends of the people of the Valley of Mexico. According to these legends, problem with where those come from. Okay, after his exile from Tula, the god traveled east, crossing the sea on a raft of snakes. Okay, so that's made up. He would return one day, bringing a new reign of light and peace. The myth of Quetzalcoatl would come back to haunt the greatest empire of Mexico, the Aztecs. So who in world history is a man god who lives on earth, goes away, and then hundreds of millions of people wait for centuries and centuries for him to return and bring a new reign of light and peace? We all know the answer, right? It's not Quetzalcoatl. That's Jesus Christ. So there's a big clue as to who invented this idea and this legend. But the problem is that the setup then is so that now the Aztecs are going to inherit this mantle, this civilization or barbarous culture from the Toltecs, and they are going to need to be redeemed. They are going to need someone to bring a new reign of light and peace. And who's that going to be? Right? Mm. It's in the student mind, they may not be conscious, but subconsciously they have to see that when they get to the Aztecs, they're just waiting for Cortez to show up and bring Christianity, and then everything's going to be fine. So you know, the problem Fritz and I have with this is that this is exactly the way that this history was rewritten and promoted in the 16th century by people who had a very specific imperial agenda. And for us still to be teaching our children this 500 years later means there has been an absolutely colossal failure of scholarship and education.
Mm, wow, that's a powerful statement.
I'm trying to be provocative
and we haven't even gotten to the Aztecs yet. I was worried we might not have enough to talk about. John, I think you have one last thing to say before we get to the Aztecs.
Yeah, let me just tag on to that, and it will be the segue into the Aztecs. Of course, all of these names are names that were given by the Mexica, who were then called the Aztecs. So it's somewhat funny that we talk about Teotihuacan and we talk about the Toltecs, who carry names. Well, the Toltecs we think might have called themselves Toltecs, but we know for sure that the Mexica, that is the Aztecs, called them the Toltecs. We have no idea what the Teotihuacanos called themselves. We don't even know what language they spoke, although it might well have been part of the bigger Uto-Aztecan language family, but we do not know for sure.
Thank you to my guest and also to Colin McGrath for the beautiful background music. You can check out all of Colin's music, including his amazing album Window Seat, on Spotify. You can also take a look at my books, upcoming picture books, materials for teachers, and writings on authentic assessment and other topics in social studies like role plays and mock trials at davidsharon.com. Thanks for joining me today. Hope you come on back.